Welcome to the Business News Podcast. We're here to give you the crucial financial intelligence you need. And this is a really important time, right as we're heading into that pre-holiday stretch.
It absolutely is.
This week, it felt like everything shifted. We saw this huge return to volatility, and some really fundamental fractures are starting to appear in the market's biggest story, artificial intelligence.
That's a great way to put it, fractures. You know, for anyone trying to get up to speed right now, this is essential stuff. The last few weeks were really just dictated by uncertainty.
Especially around those AI valuations.
Yes. Right?
They're just sky high.
Exactly. And what we saw this week was this really strong bounce. I mean, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ both surged. But, and this is the important part, that bounce only came after a pretty steep, sustained stumble.
So volatility is the name of the game.
It is the primary characteristic of this market right now, yes.
Okay, so let's unpack this and give you a bit of a roadmap for what we're covering. We've got four massive themes today. First, that fracturing of the AI trade you mentioned. We're talking about one giant, Alphabet, just surging, which is actually causing a lot of anxiety for others like NVIDIA. And NVIDIA is also facing its own geopolitical hurdles.
Right, the China question.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Second, we've got critical signals from the Federal Reserve that have markets, well, basically doing a happy dance about future rate cuts.
Mm.
And we need to scrutinize this really ambitious economic outlook for 2026.
A lot to dig into there.
Third, some major corporate news. Everything from a huge setback in the pharma world to the future of, believe it or not, driverless trucking. And finally, we'll get into your wallet with some essential personal finance updates.
Including the cost of your Thanksgiving turkey.
And maybe more importantly, the hidden bite that's being taken out of Social Security increases.
Right. But we have to start with the market's core challenge right now, which is just that uncertainty. The narrative shifted so quickly this week. It moved away from this, you know, universal faith in every single AI-related stock.
Or a rising tide lifts all boats, that kind of thing.
That's over. Now it's about picking specific winners.
Mm-hmm.
And even with the big gains on Monday, the whole environment just feels fragile. Investors are actively reconsidering those stratospheric valuations on all the AI names that really powered the market's success this year.
Which brings us right to part one, the fractured AI trade. For months, it felt like the story was so simple. NVIDIA sells the shovels, everyone's in a gold rush, everyone buys them.
Right.
This week, the market declared a new frontrunner, at least for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Alphabet.
And what's so fascinating is the sheer power of that Alphabet story. The stock was up, what, 5-6% on Monday alone?
That's a huge move for a company that size.
It's massive. And the momentum is being fueled by two things that are really interconnected. First, the launch of their new, very advanced Gemini 3 AI model.
Mm-hmm.
And second, the benefits they're seeing from their own custom-built infrastructure. We're talking specifically about their tensor processing unit chips, their TPUs.
This technical distinction is really everything here, isn't it? It feels like investors are suddenly waking up to the difference between training an AI model and actually running it, what they call inference.
Precisely. For the better part of 2 years, the entire focus, all the money, was on the training phase. You know, training these huge foundational models like GPT or Gemini.
And that takes a ton of power.
An enormous amount. It requires these huge clusters of NVIDIA's best chips, the H100s or the H200s. And NVIDIA absolutely dominates that market. There's no question.
Right.
But once that model is trained, you have to run it at scale. For millions, maybe billions of users all at once. And that's the inference phase.
Mm-hmm.
And what Alphabet has done is build these custom TPUs that are specifically optimized to run their own models, like Gemini, incredibly fast and much, much more efficiently inside their own data centers.
And that efficiency, that speed, that's exactly what Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff was talking about when he gave Gemini 3 that huge public endorsement.
That endorsement was a critical signal to the market. I mean, the quote is striking. He said, "I've used ChatGPT every day for 3 years. Just spent 2 hours on Gemini 3. I'm not going back."
Wow. I'm not going back.
Yeah, he went on. "The leap is insane. Reasoning, speed, images, video. Everything is sharper and faster. It feels like the world just changed again." When a major CEO highlights the speed like that, he is talking directly about better inference, and that's powered by Google's own in-house chips.
So, if I'm understanding this right, if Alphabet is successfully shifting its massive workload, this inference workload, from NVIDIA's general-purpose GPUs to its own custom-made TPUs, well, the market anxiety makes perfect sense.
It's completely logical.
That's a massive potential hit to future demand for NVIDIA's main product line.
Yeah.
Even if they still dominate the training part.
That is the fracturing that analysts are talking about. It's the market waking up to the fact that the AI war isn't just one fight. It's a whole series of battles. There's training, there's inference, there's the application layer. And the hyperscalers, you know, Google, Amazon, they're building these defensive walls around their own ecosystems using their own custom silicon.
So Alphabet's win is seen as NVIDIA's potential loss.
That's the fear. The success of one giant hurts the other core AI stocks, and that's primarily NVIDIA and all of its ecosystem partners.
But despite that fear, it's not like the money is leaving the sector. It's just moving around.
Exactly. It's diversifying. Look at the other names that moved on Monday. Broadcom, which is key for networking and custom silicon, was up 9%.
9%.
Micron Technology, which makes the special high bandwidth memory that all AI processing needs, that was up 8%. AMD, a direct competitor to NVIDIA, popped over 5%. So yeah, the money is still there, but the market is getting much more selective.
It's looking for companies that aren't just selling parts to the giants.
Right. They're looking for companies that are integrating vertically or providing some kind of essential non-redundant service.
This all leads to the really big question that's been lurking behind all these technical shifts, which is, are we in an AI bubble?
It's an unavoidable question. I mean, you just have to look at the sheer scale of the investment that's being planned. The big hyperscalers, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Meta, they're projected to spend an astonishing $420 billion this year alone.
$420 billion just this year.
On foundational AI infrastructure. And that number is forecast to just skyrocket to $600 billion a year by 2027.
$600 billion a year. That number is just, It's truly staggering. What's the major risk here beyond just obvious overvaluation?
The risk is the return on that investment. You know, historically, when you spend this much money, you need to generate corresponding revenue and profit, and you need to do it quickly. And analysts are getting more and more worried that the pace of capital expenditure, the build-out phase, is just outpacing the revenue being generated by actual AI adoption in the real world.
So the fear is they build it and nobody comes. Or not enough people come quickly enough.
Right. If the applications don't materialize fast enough, or if the market fractures even more, that $600 billion in infrastructure could become this massive, underutilized sunk cost.
You know, I think what makes this particular tech revolution feel so different, so strange, is the public mood around it. We've heard this term, the joyless tech revolution. And I think we need to spend a moment on that because it just perfectly captures the disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street.
It's probably the most important sociological takeaway from this whole market cycle. It captures that tension perfectly. On one hand, you have these massive market gains. Your retirement fund, your 401k, if it's heavily in tech, it might be hitting all-time highs.
You look at your statement and you feel good.
For a moment. But on the other hand, there is this widespread public discomfort, wariness, even, you know, existential fear about what AI is going to do.
Yeah, unlike the dot-com boom in the late 90s, that felt like a party everyone was invited to, you know? You had new IPO millionaires, exciting new websites and consumer apps. This just feels different, feels very detached.
It's so different. The dot-com era felt, for better or worse, like a democratizing force. A chance for disruption and new accessibility. This current AI wave is being led by these massive established corporations that are already among the wealthiest in the world.
And the perception isn't that it's creating jobs, it's that it's replacing them.
Exactly. And it's specifically targeting intellectual, white-collar, creative careers. We're seeing a lot of data now showing that automation anxiety is hitting younger workers, people in their 20s and 30s, particularly hard. They don't see these gains translating into higher wages or better job stability for them. They see a technology that could fundamentally narrow their entire career path.
So the stock market goes up, making the already wealthy richer, while the average person feels more insecure about their own ability to earn a living.
That's the core of it. It creates this kind of modern Luddite anxiety. But, you know, instead of smashing knitting frames, people are looking for regulatory intervention because they deeply, deeply distrust the industry that's driving this change.
And that just piles on top of existing economic worries.
Absolutely. It compounds worries about inflation, about housing costs, and it makes AI feel less like progress and more like just another factor making life more insecure. The total lack of public excitement about this immense technological leap is why that phrase, joyless tech revolution, is just so potent.
Okay, pivoting from that domestic sentiment to international friction. The fracturing of the AI trade doesn't stop with Alphabet. It's also deeply tied to geopolitical issues, specifically with NVIDIA in China.
Right. NVIDIA's stability is just constantly under threat from political decisions made in Washington. The critical issue right now is this pivotal decision the government is facing about NVIDIA's exports to China, specifically their high-performance computing chips.
And this is high-stakes stuff. I mean, China was, what, 20% of NVIDIA's revenue before the strict restrictions came down in 2022?
It was a huge market for them, and the conflict is that classic dilemma, economic benefit versus national security. NVIDIA's CEO, Jensen Huang, has been arguing very strongly for renewed but controlled market access to China.
What's his argument?
His argument is that maintaining engagement, even if you're just supplying slightly older, controlled technology, it keeps Chinese developers reliant on American tech. It maintains America's global influence.
So the other side of that?
The other side, the congressional hawks, they argue that supplying any high-caliber AI technology is an unacceptable national security risk. They point to the dual-use potential, you know, using AI to enhance military capabilities, surveillance, cyber warfare.
So what are the specific chips being talked about right now? Why is this negotiation so complicated?
Well, the U.S. is debating whether to allow sales of the H200 chip. Now, that's based on the older Hopper architecture, not the newest Blackwell. But right now, NVIDIA is only allowed to ship the H20 chip into China.
And the H20 is a much, much weaker version, right?
It's a significantly degraded version. It was built specifically to comply with those 2022 restrictions. It's heavily throttled.
And what's the market reaction in China to that H20 chip? Are they buying it?
They're shunning it. Market reports are really clear on this. Chinese developers are largely refusing to buy the H20. Its performance is just too throttled. Specifically, the interconnect bandwidth and compute capabilities are so reduced that it offers almost no competitive advantage over the domestic alternatives that are getting better and better.
So the U.S. restrictions have basically created a vacuum, and Chinese companies like Huawei are now successfully filling it.
Exactly. The ban has just intensified China's massive push for semiconductor self-sufficiency. They are accelerating these huge state-backed chip investments, over $50 billion since 2023, and they're actively using rivals like Huawei's Ascend series chips.
So the policy has backfired in a way.
You could argue it has inadvertently accelerated fragmentation. It's forcing Chinese AI to develop on a divergent path from Western standards, creating this parallel ecosystem. So the ultimate decision now for the U.S. is, do you try to re-engage with the slightly better H200 chip to maintain some control, or do you stick with the strict policy that just accelerates that fragmentation?
Shifting to another story of massive investment in American AI leadership, let's look at Amazon Web Services, AWS. They have a staggering $50 billion commitment to the U.S. government. And this seems to be about much more than just chips.
Oh, this is a monumental investment. And it goes right to the heart of American supercomputing capability. AWS announced a plan to build and deploy purpose-built AI and high-performance computing HPC infrastructure, specifically for U.S. government agencies.
And this is up to $50 billion starting in 2026.
Up to $50 billion. And you're right, this isn't just about general cloud growth. This is about strategic national capability.
$50 billion is just an unbelievable number. To try and grasp the scale of this, what does 1.3 gigawatts of capacity even mean in this context?
Well, to put 1.3 gigawatts in perspective, that's equivalent to the power output of several large nuclear reactors.
Wow.
That's the sheer electrical capacity you need to run the next generation of supercomputers. And AWS is adding this capacity across their most sensitive hypersecure regions, AWS Top Secret, AWS Secret, and the GovCloud regions. We're talking about infrastructure built from the ground up to handle classified mission-critical government work.
And what's the core mission here? Why is the government going to pay AWS $50 billion for this specific infrastructure?
The core purpose is to accelerate critical government missions. It's about removing the technological bottlenecks that have always stalled decision making. We're talking about everything from enhancing cybersecurity to enabling drug discovery to radically supporting defense and intelligence workflows.
So the goal is just speed.
The CEO of AWS, Matt Garman, he said this investment fundamentally transforms how agencies can use supercomputing. The goal is simple. Achieve tasks in hours that used to take weeks or months.
Can you give us a concrete example? How does that accelerated timeline actually change a government function?
Sure. Think about intelligence and defense. Right now, fusing decades of satellite images, sensor data, historical patterns, it's a long, laborious process. It relies on human analysts sifting through mountains of material.
Right.
With this new capacity, advanced AI models can process all of that data at once. They can automatically detect threats as they emerge and generate comprehensive, pre-vetted response plans. So, for example, a global security analysis that used to be a 3-week cycle can become an immediate, actionable insight.
So it's about applying speed to a scale that was previously impossible.
That's it. Or in drug discovery, an agency can now identify a critical health threat, like a new virus, and the system can instantly run these high-fidelity simulations against billions of chemical compounds. It can lead to AI-driven drug recommendations in days, not years.
And they'll have access to a whole suite of tools.
A whole suite. Amazon SageMaker for training models, Bedrock for deploying them, specialized chips like Trainium and Nova, and they'll still have access to NVIDIA's infrastructure too. That flexibility is crucial for government agencies.
And this really just builds on AWS's long history as a leader in government cloud.
It absolutely does. I mean, they were the first to get accreditation across all U.S. data classifications, unclassified, secret, and top secret, all the way back in 2017. This $50 billion investment just reinforces their strategic position as the critical partner for national security and innovation. It's about making sure the government's tech keeps pace with the private sector.
Let's shift gears now, moving from these big strategic investments to the levers of the present, macroeconomics and interest rates. The market surge we talked about at the top wasn't just about Alphabet. It was heavily influenced by a perceived shift at the Federal Reserve.
Oh, that was the key driver that changed sentiment across the entire market this week. After some comments from New York Fed President John Williams, the possibility of a rate cut suddenly felt much more real to traders.
What did he say?
He signaled that he still sees room for further adjustment to interest rates. He basically indicated that he thinks policy is moving closer to neutral, meaning it's not overly restrictive anymore, but it's not overly stimulative either.
And the futures market is now pricing in a December cut as a near certainty. That's a huge reversal from just a week or two ago.
It's a dramatic reversal. The futures markets are now assigning almost a 70% probability of a 25 basis point rate cut at the December 10th FOMC meeting. That's up from only about 44% just the week before.
So what's the bigger implication?
The larger and I think more important implication is the long-term outlook. The market is now factoring in roughly 3% interest rates by next Christmas. That's a full percentage point below where we are today.
3% rates by next Christmas. That's a huge potential difference for every part of the economy, but especially for housing.
It has immediate practical consequences for you, for the consumer. Historically, when the market gets this convinced that a Fed cut is coming, mortgage rates start to fall right away, even before the Fed acts.
They decouple from the Fed funds rate.
Exactly. So the 30-year mortgage rate, which is hovering around 6.25%, it could see significant sustained relief if the market's conviction holds. And that would be a much-needed cooling mechanism for the housing market.
We should also probably touch on the search for the next Fed chair, since Chair Powell's term is up in May of 2026.
Yes. Fed Governor Christopher Waller, who's seen as a leading, maybe more hawkish candidate, he confirmed this week that he met with Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who's leading that search.
And what came of that?
Well, Waller described it as a great meeting, focused purely on economics and financial markets. He also signaled a commitment to transparency, saying he would continue Powell's practice of having news conferences after every single FOMC meeting, which has become really key to how the Fed communicates.
From the Fed's signals to the White House's outlook, we have Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent offering a remarkably optimistic long-term view for the U.S. economy in 2026.
His forecast is bold. It's unequivocal. He believes the U.S. economy as a whole is not at risk of a recession in 2026. He said he's very, very optimistic about strong, non-inflationary growth, arguing the worst is behind us.
And he's attributing that predicted strength to the administration's policies, specifically citing something called the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. What is he talking about? What policies are supposed to be bolstering the economy 2 years from now?
He pointed to a few key things. The bill includes making the 2017 tax cuts permanent, which he argues gives long-term certainty to businesses. It also includes some specialized bonuses for seniors to offset Social Security taxes and new tax breaks for tip income and overtime pay for workers. He also promised healthcare costs would finally come down.
But even Bessent had to acknowledge that this optimism isn't universal across the entire economy.
That's right. He did concede that housing and other sectors that are sensitive to interest rates have been in a recession. He acknowledged that those parts of the economy are definitely struggling. He also mentioned that the longest ever government shutdown, which was 44 days, also weighed on the economy and created a drag on productivity.
If we connect all this back to the bigger picture, it seems like the one thing supporting the market, regardless of who's in the White House, is this ongoing massive fiscal stimulus from the federal deficit.
That really explains why so many market strategists are still bullish, despite all the volatility. The government is running a guaranteed major fiscal stimulus. The deficit is expected to be between $1.8 and $1.9 trillion for the next several years. You have to think of that deficit spending as a kind of non-traditional quantitative easing.
How does a $1.9 trillion deficit act like quantitative easing? And why is that bullish for stocks?
Well, when the government spends $1.9 trillion more than it takes in, it has to issue debt treasury bonds to cover that gap. That issuance and spending injects a massive amount of liquidity directly into the economy. It increases the money supply.
It's basically printing money.
As one strategist put it, if the government is just increasing the money supply and effectively debasing the dollar, making each dollar worth a little bit less than stocks, which represent real assets and future earnings, they should go up simply because the currency you measure them in is losing value. It's a guaranteed persistent stimulus.
And yet, there's this profound disconnect on the ground. The Treasury Secretary is optimistic about 2026, but consumers today are miserable. Consumer sentiment in November hit its lowest level in 3 years, and unemployment, while it's still low historically, did tick up to 4.4%.
That disconnect requires a really deep look. Why are people so unhappy if the economy is supposedly avoiding a recession? Well, first, the pain isn't evenly distributed, as Bessin admitted. And second, the labor market is showing this really unique anomaly that some people are calling low hire, low fire.
Tell us more about that. What is low hire, low fire?
It's an environment where you have a very low pace of hiring, but at the same time, surprisingly high productivity. Companies are really hesitant to let go of their existing employees. That's the low fire part, because they still remember how painful it was trying to rehire people after the pandemic.
Right.
But they're also very slow to bring on new, younger workers. That's the low hire part.
So the high productivity is just coming from squeezing more output from the existing workforce, who are probably being helped by tech and AI.
That's exactly it. AI and new tech are making existing employees hyperproductive, often without needing to hire more staff. So this maturity in the economic cycle, combined with these tech changes, means the labor market is just getting worse at absorbing large numbers of young people. So unemployment is kind of stuck in that 4 to 4.5% range, which is technically full employment, but the underlying trend is really frustrating for anyone new to the workforce or trying to switch careers. And that's what fuels that terrible consumer sentiment.
Okay, let's transition now to corporate news and sector shifts. And we have to start with a major shock in the pharma space, Novo Nordisk. Their shares took a huge plunge, up to 11%, after some really disappointing drug trial results.
This was a major, major event. And it was because it involved semaglutide, which is the active ingredient in their blockbuster weight loss drugs, Ozempic and Wegovy.
Right.
The trial was testing an older oral version of semaglutide, but for a completely different purpose, to see if it could slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease. And unfortunately, the trial failed to meet its main goal.
The company itself had called the trial a lottery ticket, which really tells you what kind of immense stakes they were playing for by trying to get into the Alzheimer's market.
The potential upside was just enormous. If a GLP-1 weight loss drug could successfully treat Alzheimer's, it would have opened up one of the largest and most difficult therapeutic markets in the world. Current treatments only slow progression by about a third, and they come with really serious side effects.
This is a big blow.
It's a big blow. It really dents the hopes that this class of drugs could be a breakthrough in neurodegeneration. We saw Eli Lilly, their main competitor. Their shares slipped a little bit in sympathy, but not by much.
Now, beyond this trial failure, Novo Nordisk has actually been dealing with a lot of internal turbulence related to the success of its weight loss drugs.
Yeah, this is a really crucial internal story about corporate governance. Novo has had significant leadership changes over the past year. They recently replaced their CEO after an 8-year run, and they replaced their chairman. The turbulence came from a disagreement with the controlling shareholder, the Novo Nordisk Foundation. The foundation criticized the old leadership for being, and this is a quote, too slow in recognizing the significance of the market changes in the United States.
What specific changes were they too slow on?
Primarily two things. The rise of fierce competition and the need for immediate, massive expansion of their supply chain. The foundation felt the company was too slow to fight back against compounders. These pharmacies selling cheaper, sometimes unregulated copycat versions of the drug. The new CEO moved very quickly to refocus on their core business and announced plans to cut over 10% of the global workforce. So this Alzheimer's trial failure just adds more pressure on this new leadership.
Moving from pharma to consumer spending. Let's look at retail. We've got some major corporate news there, starting with Kohl's.
Right. Kohl's announced that Michael J. Bender has been promoted to permanent CEO. He had been serving as the interim CEO since May, and this follows a pretty turbulent period.
Right.
The previous CEO was fired after an investigation into policy violations and a conflict of interest.
So Bender's is now in charge of a really crucial turnaround. How are the recent financials looking? Is the effort working?
There are some cautious signs of stabilization. In the second quarter, net sales were down about 5% and comparable sales dropped 4%. So still declines.
But better than expected.
Better than expected, yeah. And critically, the company managed to improve its margins and cut expenses, which led them to lift their profit forecast for 2025. The whole turnaround strategy is really focused on two things: strengthening their private brands to get better margins, and then leaning into their value appeal with aggressive couponing to capture that cost-conscious family shopper.
We also saw an evolution in Gap's strategy, which I think reflects the massive shift in how you, the consumer, are shopping today.
Gap's strategy is moving toward what their CEO called a precision point for their retail stores. They've been aggressively pruning and optimizing their footprint. They closed 56 stores last year, with 35 more planned for this year.
So now they're shifting focus.
They are. Instead of just mass closures, they're now looking at new store openings and refreshes, but only in very specific high-opportunity locations. And they're doing this because their online business continues to perform really well. For Gap, it's all about creating the most profitable omnichannel experience.
Let's shift gears now to the heavy transport industry and the autonomous trucking revolution. It seems like adoption has been slower than all the hype suggested, but the technology is definitely out there moving freight today.
That's the exact status. Level 4 autonomous trucking, which means truly driverless capability, it's not theoretical anymore. Companies like Kodiak AI are already operating a fleet of 10 driverless trucks, mostly in the Permian Basin. But you're right, widespread adoption is taking longer than people expected, mainly because of ecosystem issues.
What specific ecosystem challenges are slowing this down if the core tech actually works on the highway?
It's all about integration, both physical and digital. Physically, you have the incredibly complex problem of the first and last 100 feet in a yard.
Right, getting into the loading dock.
Exactly. Maneuvering a driverless 18-wheeler into a complex, dynamic logistics terminal with human-driven trucks, forklifts, people walking around, that's a huge hurdle for autonomy. And then digitally, fleets have to figure out how to integrate all of this seamlessly into their existing transportation management systems, their TMS.
But maybe the most absurd and fascinating barrier is a single federal regulation that's just a complete roadblock to true driverless deployment.
This is where the rubber meets the regulatory road. And yeah, the conflict is almost hilarious in its bureaucracy. The specific federal rule that's stopping this says that a human driver must physically place those reflective warning triangles around a stop truck within 10 minutes of pulling over onto the shoulder of a highway.
Which is, by definition, impossible if there is no human driver in the cab.
Exactly. This outdated rule, designed for the human era, it creates an existential barrier for level 4 deployment. And it's led to this flurry of exemption requests from tech companies. Aurora, for example, had an exemption request denied when they wanted to use warning beacons instead of triangles.
So what do?
They filed a lawsuit, arguing the denial would impede the development of the autonomous trucking industry. They eventually got permission, but it just highlights how difficult it is to fit cutting-edge tech into these decades-old rule books.
So how are companies trying to solve this broader regulatory issue now?
They're pushing for broader future-proof rules. A company called Imams Technology is proposing a new federal standard that would allow for an alternative alert system. Their solution is a dynamic digital LED directive messaging sign that's mounted on the back of the truck.
So a digital sign instead of a physical triangle? What's the argument for that being safer?
The argument is all about safety and speed. A digital sign provides an immediate warning, it's visible from a greater distance, and it instantly tells other drivers to move over. A human driver needs up to 10 minutes to get out, walk into traffic, and place the physical devices. An autonomous truck can activate that digital message instantly, which is inherently safer for everyone.
As this tech moves forward, the huge question for any fleet operator or insurer is financial liability. Who pays when a level 4 truck gets into an accident?
That liability is so murky right now, and that uncertainty is probably the single biggest factor slowing down fleet adoption. In an accident, it's just not clear who takes the most risk. Is it the OEM who made the truck? Is it the autonomous tech provider like Kodiak? Or is it the fleet operator who dispatched the truck?
It's fascinating, though, that the technology that causes this liability problem might also be the technology that solves it because of all the data.
Absolutely. The massive trove of data these trucks collect, telemetry, video, sensor readings, it's a huge asset for insurers. This data can effectively eliminate the need for costly, time-consuming crash scene reconstruction. As one OEM manager said, for insurance folks, this tech provides so much data that there's really no question about what happened.
You just rewind and hit play.
Exactly. And that immense efficiency will eventually help insurers quickly and accurately figure out who is liable and dramatically cut down on legal costs.
Okay, so we have to address the ultimate question. Will these trucks replace human drivers entirely?
The industry consensus on this is very firm. Autonomous trucking is driverless, not humanless. It is not expected to replace the occupation. It's expected to shift the workforce.
Shift it to how?
The focus will move from people physically sitting in the cab for 12 hours a day to people near the cab remote monitors, dispatch assistants, specialized mechanics. And the technology is primarily targeting the most undesirable long-haul routes, like Dallas to Atlanta, where the hours of service rules are really tough to manage. It's about filling a critical capacity gap, not displacing local and regional drivers.
Let's shift our focus now to part four, which covers the fragile crypto market and some key fintech moves. Despite the rally in stocks driven by those Fed cut hopes, crypto has just not caught the same momentum.
No, it really hasn't. Crypto has remained in this deep bear sentiment. It has decoupled significantly from the recent stock market enthusiasm. We are still seeing a severe sell-off. Bitcoin is down a brutal 17%. Quarter to date, it's down 24% since its October peak.
And the total crypto market cap?
It has plummeted by over $1 trillion in value during this period.
That really sounds like institutional capitulation.
It is, in a big way. We've seen the U.S. Bitcoin ETFs log these massive outflows, $903 million. And overall, institutional ETF outflows in November hit $3.5 billion. That's the highest level since February.
And what about the long-term holders, the HO dealers?
Even they are selling. Long-term holders, the people who almost never sell, have sold over 800,000 Bitcoin in the last month alone. That is the highest level of sustained selling from that group we have seen all year. Institutional capital is leaving rapidly.
If the Fed cut expectation is so bullish for stocks, why is it not providing any relief for Bitcoin?
Well, crypto strategists are viewing this potential 25 basis point cut as a hawkish cut for digital assets.
A hawkish cut? How so?
They argue that the resistance will persist because 25 basis points is just a minor acknowledgement that inflation is cooling. It's not a strong signal of a full pivot back to easy money. They believe resistance will only break if the Fed signals a much more dovish path, like an immediate 50 basis point cut or a sustained commitment to aggressive easing. This move just isn't enough to trigger a recovery in the short term.
And we know the correlation with the broader tech market is still a major factor.
That correlation is extremely tight. Bitcoin and the Nasdaq have become highly correlated. If the big AI names and tech stocks stay volatile, which they are because of this fracturing trade, crypto is going to struggle to outperform. Bitcoin is acting like the ultimate high beta asset right now. It's just highly sensitive to general risk appetite.
So despite all this short-term pain, is there still a long-term bullish view for crypto out there?
Yes, absolutely. The head of strategy at Coinbase Institutional recently noted that structurally, nothing fundamental has changed the long-term bull case. They're still competent because they see increasing diversity and breadth in who is participating in the market. You've got institutional players, sophisticated hedgers, and consistent retail investors.
So what is that fundamental long-term bull case for the average investor?
The long-term view really relies on wider adoption as younger generations' wealth grows. The argument is that crypto, especially Bitcoin, will function as a universal, borderless, accessible store of value right alongside traditional investments. The belief is that systematic investment dollar cost averaging into both the U.S. economy via stocks and into Bitcoin is the best long-term hedge against inflation, especially when the government is running these huge deficits that debase the dollar.
Now, for a bit of a counter-narrative from the fintech space, we saw the neobank Revolut report a massive valuation boost, despite all this broader crypto gloom.
This is a great signal that quality, integrated fintech services are still in very high demand. Revolut's valuation just soared to $75 billion, and this was following a private share sale that attracted major institutional investors. We're talking Fidelity, Franklin Templeton, Andreessen Horowitz, and even NVIDIA's own venture capital arm.
And that valuation reflects really strong financial performance.
Incredibly strong. Their revenue surged 72% in 2024 to $4 billion, and their profit before tax jumped 149% to $1.4 billion.
And they are cementing their connection to the crypto world, positioning themselves as this compliant bridge between traditional finance and digital assets.
They're integrating very deeply. Revolut recently got a MiCA license in Cyprus, which positions them as a trusted provider within the EU's regulatory framework. And they're also actively considering launching their own stablecoin. Their mission is very clear: become the most trusted and accessible provider of integrated crypto and banking services with a very strong compliance-first approach. And that's what attracted those big institutional investors.
Finally, let's talk about the American wallet and personal finance right before the holiday season. And we have some genuinely good news when it comes to the centerpiece of the Thanksgiving table.
We do. And this is a much-needed piece of good news for the family budget. For the third straight year, the cost of the classic Thanksgiving dinner has actually gone down. According to the American Farm Bureau Federation's 40th annual survey, a meal for 10 people, the overall cost is $55.18.
Which is a 5% decrease from last year.
5% decrease, yeah.
So where is that significant relief coming from?
The biggest saving by far is coming from the turkey itself. The average price for a 16-pound frozen turkey dropped dramatically down 16.3% to an average of $1.34 a pound.
And why is that?
It's two things. First, slightly lower overall consumer demand compared to those pandemic-era peaks. And second, and this is critical, aggressive holiday deals from grocery stores. They use turkey as a loss leader to get you in the door. So even though farmers are still rebuilding flocks that were decimated by avian influenza, these promotions really helped keep the bird affordable.
But not everything on the table got cheaper. Some items saw pretty sharp price rises.
Yeah. Anything sensitive to weather, labor costs, and transportation saw big jumps. For example, the veggie tray, your carrots and celery, was up over 61% from last year.
61%.
Mostly due to labor costs and logistics. Sweet potatoes were up 37%, largely because of hurricane damage that hit the yields in North Carolina, which is the biggest grower. And the survey also highlighted big regional differences. The South was the most affordable place for the meal at just over $50, while the West was the most expensive at over $61.
So, relief on the turkey, but definite strain on the sides. Let's move to a crucial long-term personal finance issue for retirees. The 2026 Social Security Cost of Living Adjustment, or CCLA.
Right. The Social Security Administration announced the CLA for 2026 will be 2.8%, which is a little larger than last year. However, that raise may not go very far at all, and it's due to two major erosive factors that disproportionately hit seniors.
What are those factors? Why is a 2.8% increase not enough for many people?
Well, reason one is the flaw in the inflation index they use. It's called the CPIW, the Consumer Price Index for Urban Wage Earners and Clerical Workers. And as the name suggests, it's designed to track costs for working people, not retirees.
So it underweights the things seniors spend the most on.
It significantly underweights costs that are critical for seniors, like healthcare and housing, while it overweighs costs like transportation that younger workers face more.
So the index just doesn't measure the reality of a senior's budget.
Exactly. Advocacy groups like the Senior Citizens League report that recipients lost 20% of their buying power between 2010 and 2024 because the CLAs, based on the CPIW, just didn't keep up with the specific costs seniors were facing. That 2.8% feels immediately insufficient to many.
And the second major factor is the inevitable substantial increase in Medicare premiums.
That's reason two, and it is a massive hidden cut. The standard monthly Medicare Part B premium is deducted automatically from your Social Security benefits, and for 2026, that standard premium is rising substantially from $185 to $202.90. That's a $17.90 increase every month.
And that $17.90 will cut deeply into the raise, won't it?
It consumes a huge portion of it. For the average monthly retirement benefit, which is around $2,015, that's set to rise by about $56 with the new CLA. Well, the Medicare premium hike will consume roughly 32% of that raise right off the top.
A third of the raise is gone before it even hits your bank account.
Immediately. So while most people will still see a modest net increase, the fact that a third of the CLA is eaten up by healthcare highlights that structural financial strain that retirees are under.
Given that these CLA increases are insufficient, we should probably touch on the role of stable income investment strategies for retirement planning.
Right. When inflation is eroding your Social Security, seniors often have to turn to reliable income streams. The SPDR S&P Dividend ETF, the ticker is SDY, that's a popular choice for this demographic. It specifically targets companies that have increased their dividends for 20 consecutive years and have strong financials.
And what's the yield on that?
SDY currently has an average yield of about 2.56%. This kind of consistent growing income stream is favored by investors who are looking to supplement what Social Security is structurally failing to fully cover.
Finally, let's conclude the personal finance segment by looking at consumer vulnerability around just everyday necessities.
This brings us right back to that systemic financial strain, utility debt. This is a worsening trend. More and more Americans are falling behind on their utility bills, gas, electricity, water, and that has led to a really worrying increase in power shutoffs across the country. Reports indicate that rising utility costs are just overwhelming American families, and it highlights a major vulnerability right before the winter season really hits.
So, as we close out this period of really intense news flow, what does it all mean?
It means we are operating under massive tension. On the macro level, the market is betting very heavily on a Fed rate cut and on that significant guaranteed government stimulus from these massive deficits. That provides a fundamental bullish floor for stocks. But that optimism is constantly battling this severe specific volatility that's coming from the AI sector fracturing, where one giant success causes anxiety for everyone else, and the ever-present geopolitical debates, like the future of NVIDIA's access to China.
And for you, the consumer, the immediate good news of a cheaper Thanksgiving turkey is really just masking some very real, very severe long-term financial pressures.
Precisely. While the headline cost of the holiday meal is down, the fundamental long-term costs of living, especially utility bills and rising Medicare premiums, combined with KLA increases that don't really track senior expenses, it all means that financial strain remains a major and increasing factor for millions of households. The economic recovery is leaving a lot of people behind.
We discussed Amazon's $50 billion commitment to build hyper-secure, purpose-built supercomputing for the U.S. government, designed to process decades of data and generate critical response plans in hours instead of weeks. It's an investment targeting revolutionary missions like cybersecurity, drug discovery, and defense. Considering the scale and speed of that capability, what revolutionary mission, from protecting infrastructure to finding the next medical breakthrough, do you believe that investment will successfully accelerate first? And how will that impact your daily life in the next 3 years? Thank you for tuning into the Business News Podcast. We'll talk to you next time.